Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to inform the world of the most dangerous situations on the planet? To those of us who endure nothing worse than paper cuts and traffic jams to earn our livings, the intrepid subset of journalists who leave the relative safety of their home countries to send back news of riots and wars and natural disasters can seem almost superhuman. But even the most seasoned and dauntless correspondents were once novices in the field, forced to learn by trial and error how to stay safe and healthy in violent and chaotic environments. Rosie Garthwaite is a producer with Al Jazeera English who has worked in the Middle East for 6 years. She shares the best advice she and her colleagues in journalism, medicine, and on-the-ground aid organizations have picked up over collective decades of experience in her new book, How to Avoid Being Killed in a War Zone, The Essential Survival Guide for Dangerous Places. Rosie, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me.
I think even people who have no need or desire to go to these places may be curious about what's in the book. I think it's extraordinary, though, in that it's worth reading simply to get an appreciation for the people who are out there doing this work on our behalf.
Well, indeed. I mean, there's certainly a lot of relevance for, if you imagine, if you were on holiday in Cairo 3 or 4 months ago and everything kicked off there, there's plenty in the book that can help you. And even though I myself have not experienced the riots in Cairo, I know that all the advice in there is so relevant to because all the people in the book are so experienced and bring that wealth of experience to the problems that they address on a day-to-day basis in their work, which can unfortunately so often leak into holiday time or that other people who are less experienced have to go through. And right now, we're watching everything in Libya unfolding, or certainly I am, and it's terrifying to see how much the individual bravery of journalists really that's how much the news depends so much on the individual bravery of journalists and how far they're willing to go go outside of the mainstream journalists all cooped up, let's say, in that hotel or constantly embedded with rebels. It's difficult to always get a good story, to get the right story. So they're very reliant on very brave people they work with there locally to bring us that news.
Just as one example of the bravery that's required, I want to play about 2 minutes of a clip recorded yesterday. It was a live talkback at the time between Lourdes Garcia Navarro of NPR and Robert Siegel. She is in Libya. Let's listen back to her live report.
NPR's Lourdes Garcia Navarro is in Tripoli, inside Muammar Gaddafi's compound, and she joins us now. And Lulu, where exactly are you?
I am indeed inside Bab al-Azizia, Gaddafi's stronghold, and the place where ordinary Libyans could never get to. And I can tell you right now that thousands of them are streaming into this compound after it was taken earlier today. The scenes of celebration are absolutely incredible. Also, a real sense of chaos. Many of the people here have gone in and are looting a very large weapons storage facility that they found, and they're carrying anything they can get their hands on. So it's a real scene of chaos, but jubilation. People are just ecstatic. They say that they feel this is really the end of the war. This is where they wanted to get to. These past 6 months, the symbol of his power, and now they feel that even though they haven't captured him, they don't know where he is effectively defeated.
And is there any resistance to them at all from inside the compound, or do they have the free run of the place now?
They have the free run of the place. I mean, I can't even tell you what I'm seeing right now. People are literally running in here, and the sound that you can hear behind me of shooting is celebratory gunfire. At one point, they actually fired an RPG into Gaddafi's house, setting it ablaze, and just... smiles on their faces as they're running into this compound is really something to behold.
Lulu, can you just give us a sense, when we speak of the compound, how big an area is this? Is it enclosed within walls? How large a space are we talking about?
Bab al-Azizia has always been a very secretive location. It is indeed enclosed within a series of walls, not just one, and only has a few access points. So it was very difficult to get in here.
That, again, is a clip from a live talkback recorded yesterday between Lourdes Garcia Navarro of NPR reporting from Libya and Robert Siegel. If you want to hear the entire clip, you can find it online at npr.org. Rosie, when I hear that, I mean, it's astonishing, first of all, the poise that you hear in this journalist. And I know that they're celebratory bullets, but they can still kill you if they happen to land in the wrong place. When you hear a clip like that, are you sort of instantly transported to experiences that you've had yourself?
Yeah, it is very reminiscent of those first entries into Baghdad. I mean, I wasn't there myself, but certainly if you listen back to stuff from 2003, it feels very similar with the looting and the celebratory fire. And certainly when I first turned up at the age of 22 to go to a similar situation where it was just rain, there really was no rule of law on the ground, then you're in a, I mean, she sounds as if she knows what she's doing, but really she's making it up as she's going along, that's for sure, in terms of safety, because there is no sure thing when there is no rule of law. And understanding what is celebratory fire and understanding what isn't celebratory fire, there's no expert that can teach you that. That's something, it just comes with a little bit of a few months on the ground of being in these places.
A few months on the ground is a long time to be finding your way. Talk about at age 22, and I know that you'd served a year with the British Army between high school and college, but what were you able to know before you got to Baghdad for the first time?
Very little. I knew what bombs sounded like. I knew when they were aimed towards me and when guns weren't aimed towards me, but there's nothing that can prepare you for being surrounded by that noise. And not knowing the way to escape, and for everything, when everything is new, you always have to be alert and aware of your never. You should never feel comfortable in that situation. I think the moment you do, then you're in big trouble, and you should really leave as soon as possible. There's certainly a lot you can learn from being in the military about being safe, but really, you're very reliant on your instincts and incredibly reliant on the people you meet who live locally, who are your only sure way of knowing what is safe and what is not.
There's a story in the book about you deciding, rather than taking a hotel somewhere, to stay with a local family. How did you trust your instinct enough to say, yes, this is a good idea for me? And how did you know you could trust these people?
Gosh, you can never really know. But as a journalist, it was a choice that some people chose to take, very few. But if you look at what happened in Libya, there was that hotel where they've just been released, 35 journalists held up, all the mainstream journalists. Now, all of those people were then unable to report on what was going on. And certainly that was true for people who were in compounds in Iraq, in the green zone, just outside the green zone, tucked away in hotels. I felt, as a very young and perhaps idealistic person, that they weren't really getting the real story, and I wanted to find a way to live outside of that world, quite aside from anything. It costs about $150 a night to stay in those hotels. The more dangerous it is, the more expensive the hotel room, in my experience. So I had to find somebody to trust. Without people to trust locally, you are nothing as a journalist. You're really, just somebody parachuting in and making it up as you go along. So you have to find people to work with, and then it's tentative steps. And certainly you should never feel afraid of turning back from making that decision to trust somebody if they prove you to be wrong. But, you have to just work out. They don't need to be the best, most connected people. But if they're nice and trustworthy, those are the ones to go for.
So we're talking about journalists and aid workers and people who come in from other places to these very dangerous spots in order to do a particular job. Obviously, there are local residents who are trying to live their entire lives in these regions. What can you learn from the survival skills that the locals employ, and where do the similarities end so that you really can't do the same thing as the people who have lived there their entire lives?
Well, I would say that in most cases, in my experience, and the NGO workers certainly would tell you this, because they tend to be staying in there a lot longer than most journalists who might be passing through, and when the story's done, they're going on. NGO workers will probably tell you that the locals are the people who can tell you your own limits. They can say, this is safe, this is not safe, because they're the people who have to be staying there well beyond you. And in fact, they tend to be on the more cautious side, which is why some journalists, particularly relatively gung-ho journalists, might ignore their fixer who says, this is too dangerous, and they go ahead with it anyway and often put their whole team in danger. I mean, sometimes people are lucky and it's fine, but in general, if your local person is telling you that a street is too dangerous to go down, then there has to be a reason for it. And they have to live with the consequences as well. If something were to happen with you, if something were to happen to them, then they've got their family or they've got your family that they have to worry about then for the rest of their life.
You are adamant here that people might assume that at age 22, you told your mom and dad you were working in an office somewhere or doing something not so dangerous. But in fact, if you're going to do this kind of work, you have to be really straight with the people who care about you.
That's certainly true. To this day, I still know of journalists who have been doing this for about 45 years and still don't necessarily tell their parents that they are in a war zone until they've left it because they are afraid of upsetting their parents. And sure, everyone has their own relationship with their loved ones. But in my experience and from talking to about 150 different people who work in these dangerous places, not just journalists, the more straight up you are with them at the beginning, the more you're able to talk about what's been going on. You might not be able to talk about it while it's happening. It might be too stressful. You don't want to distress them. But if they at least have an idea of what you're going to be facing, then it's not going to be so stressful for them or for you to confront those problems that you've dealt with, that you've had to confront on a day-to-day basis when you've been away. It makes it easier and less shocking for them to deal with the trauma that you might feel, in fact, almost always feel when you come back from a really hideous situation.
Yeah, and suddenly you're having to adjust to what seems like normal life for everybody else and feels very foreign to you all of a sudden.
I mean, when I was writing this book, I just asked people to tell me what advice would you give your 18-year-old self, and I gave them a few prompts here and there, but it was amazing that probably 50 to 60% of the responses were all about the trauma and how to deal with the effects of how you are, you know, the experiences you have. And it's not just war zones. Also, it can be tsunamis or the earthquake. And it's not just people who've been sent there. It's people who accidentally have these experiences and how to deal with that trauma. And the best way to deal with it is if you can prepare, then do prepare. And so many people came back with fantastic advice and incredibly generous and honest advice about how when they came back from these situations, so often they try and pretend it hadn't happened because they felt that was the best thing for their wife or child or lover, whoever it was. So I think about 8 different men replied saying, the thing I found most distressing when I got back was coming back, seeing my baby, seeing my wife, and having to go and pick out which brand of nappy, or in your language, diaper, they wanted to use. That was a reoccurring theme. The normal things in life, what should be every day, just begin to feel very abnormal when you've been through that kind of experience.
Do you know, going into this line of work, that you have traded a certain kind of personal peace for the rest of your life?
I think that's certainly true. Some people perhaps run away from things to go into this kind of job, and other people run towards it. And you can never tell what kind of people they are, and I would never make that judgment. But in many ways, there are a lot of journalists I know who go to these places in order to answer questions rather than to run away from things. And so perhaps that is a way of them achieving inner peace because they've got these overwhelming questions that they need to have answered. And on the other hand, it's certainly true that whenever I've been writing articles or researching the subject, it's very difficult, for instance, to find any women who have babies who are in war zones. There's only one I could think of that I knew of, Janine De Giovanni. Anyone else, many, many women who have babies have given up their work in these war zones. Lara Logan, most recently, has chosen to step away from going to the front line for the moment after she was brutally attacked in Cairo. So as a woman, that's something I'm very aware of, that if I continue in this line of work, there's a very, very small percentage chance that I will be able to maintain a family. And
Rosie Garthwaite, we need to jump in and do a break here. Rosie Garthwaite is a journalist with Al Jazeera. We're talking about her new book, How to Avoid Being Killed in a War Zone. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Rosie Garthwaite. She's a journalist with Al Jazeera and author of the new book, How to Avoid Being Killed in a War Zone, The Essential Survival Guide for Dangerous Places. You can join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Rosie, Steve in Dallas writes to ask whether you've ever been physically threatened because you're a woman.
I would say I'm no more. If you were to take walking down, I don't know, a busy London high street on a Saturday night, with a man next to me, and walking down the middle of Baghdad, with a man next to me, as a foreign journalist, I'd say I'm no more at threat as a woman than I would be relatively to it being in London. I think that you have, there are individual instances where the culture means that I am at more risk, but there are also individual instances where the culture means I'm at less risk. So it's very difficult to compare the two, being a man and being a woman in a war zone. I have physically not been brutally attacked the way perhaps Lara Logan that's been documented, but I had lots of individual instances. For instance, there's one which I write about in my book where I'm trying to give first aid to somebody, and instead of being able to give the first aid, I'm basically being molested to the point where I had to leave the person because I felt like I was about to be physically attacked. There are many small instances like that where you have to make a choice to walk away or face trouble.
I was interested to read the different conclusions that you and some of your colleagues have reached with regard to whether it is better to really try your best to absolutely blend in as a local or to allow it to be obvious that you are not simply a journalist, but a Western journalist.
Yeah, that's very true. I think it makes a big difference how you look. When I first got to Iraq, I was in a house and there were several of us women there, and we were trying to make a decision on the look that we should have out on the street, since we were living in a local area, in a local district, quite a long way from where all the rest of the journalists are. We decided we should go with a sort of uniform for the house, which is often the way things are done when groups are working together, so that you don't all break rank. So it was much easier for the one girl. She had brown skin, brown hair, and dark eyes, and was able to just go to the local market and put on a headscarf, buy the local kit, local shoes, buy a local bag so she doesn't stick out with, you know, a mulberry handbag or something fancy. And she was able to blend in very, very seamlessly. I, on the other hand, have blue eyes and blonde hair and pale skin. And it was just impossible for me. So we ended up having to go in two different directions where I obviously covered up in the way that I would be expected, but I made no effort to wear what the locals would wear. I didn't even do what I would do nowadays, which is to go perhaps to the local supermarket and buy something very normal and average, so that I can fit in at least with the women around me in terms of the clothing I'm choosing to wear, not just my levels of covering up. And with men, it's a choice to grow a beard or not to grow a beard, to speak Arabic or not to speak Arabic. And each person that I spoke to had individual choices on that, and they felt very strongly about it. The BBC journalist John Simpson thinks that you should never try and blend in. Others say that they would never have got the stories they've managed to get to if they hadn't tried to blend in. And I think it's you should take it step by step in each particular case. I think it's certainly true that if you're not flaunting your wealth, that's something that is always useful to avoid.
Mm-hmm. And you say to have about $1,000 cash with you, but not on your person at all times. Is that right?
Well, no, $1,000 in cash is good to have on your person at all times, but much more than that, and you could be in a lot of trouble. You become a target if your fixer, if the person you're working with, or even let's say you're on a holiday, if the person that is your tour guide sees that you've got an awful lot of cash and it's somewhere that's a little bit dodgy, you could suddenly become a target of a kidnapping because they think, oh, well, she or he is super wealthy. Mm-hmm. And I'm being paid $70 a day when I could probably rob this guy and get $100,000 off their back pocket. Then, you're putting yourself in a very bad position.
Let's talk about kidnapping risk. One thing that you do is establish a series of regular call-ins with someone at a distance. And if you don't make that call, you know, an hour goes by and they know to be concerned, and 2 or 3 hours go and they're setting emergency measures in place.
Yeah, it's true. If you are, for instance, going on a long walk, I imagine that many people, went before they head off for a long hike or a 2 or 3 day hike, unlike that famous story now, 127 hours, they would have a regular, there would be somebody who knew they were going and somebody who was waiting for a phone call to know that they were all right. It's always sensible to do that, especially in dangerous places. And so if you can set up a system whereby you're expected to call in, and if you don't call in, the team back at home, whether they be at, you know, 3,000 miles away or just 100 miles away, they will activate some kind of system to start looking for you, at least, if not, perhaps begin some kind of search for you if it's somewhere particularly dangerous. And that's a great idea. Very simple, too.
And you'd like to have one, or even better, two charged cell phones with you at all times. And you go through your contact list before you travel somewhere dangerous. Talk about that.
Yeah, it's a very good idea to, it's always a good, as many forms of communication as possible is great, as long as they're not going to make you look suspect if you're captured by the wrong type of people, or if perhaps an army thinks you're a spy because you've got 15 different phones all fully charged with GPS capability, you're going to start to look a bit dodgy. It is a very good idea to have those cell phones on you and to check what information you've got on there. So you don't want to be giving away a lot of personal information. If there is a high likelihood you're going to be kidnapped, perhaps having somebody who you would have as your next of kin under mum or dad is not a great idea. Have them under a different name, and then when kidnappers get confused and don't know who to call, you will be able to have a little bit of extra power in that situation. If you've got, for instance, if you're traveling in an area which is of one particular sect and you have a whole series of names that belong to the other sect that they don't get on with very well, then it's not a good idea to have them under their original names. Put it under, instead of Ali, have them under some neutral name, or perhaps assign people numbers if you really want to keep their identities a secret. A lot of people also suggested to me when they were writing in with advice to have one number that was your safety number that they did label with mum or dad or home. And then when that person got called, they knew that you were in trouble because there's no way you would call that number. It was only because a kidnapper got hold of your phone or a robber had got hold of your phone and was trying to use that phone to make some extra cash out of you.
You thankfully have never been kidnapped, but have spoken with people who have. I was really interested that the one point, there's some practical information and things to do, and we'll talk about those in a minute. But the point that you make over and over is that you need to remember that somebody is working to get you out, no matter how hopeless it seems.
Yeah, it was one of the most interesting things in writing the book is speaking to people like Terry Waite, who was held for so many years in Lebanon, and others, some friends of mine who've been in an amazingly diverse range of kidnapping situations, and what they believe very surely is the way out. One of the women I spoke to was a woman called Shirley Williams, who is right at the top of the tree when it comes to hostage negotiations. And they have a very clear idea of what the best way is to get somebody out in the quickest time possible. And it's going to be very different from what the hostage believes is the best idea. Because for a hostage negotiator, the longer you can make the kidnappers wait, the more antsy they're going to get, the more nervous they're going to get that they're going to get captured, the more nervous they get that your value is not as high as they first thought. So the value starts dropping. And the hostage negotiators I spoke to said there is never a hostage situation where money isn't on the table in some way or another. Despite all governments' refusal to talk about that, it's something that happens all the time. And so for them, it's a matter of reducing the money down to a place which is reasonable, because if they feel they've given away too much, then it's highly likely that the kidnappers will take advantage and either re-kidnap you or up the stakes at the very last minute, or even just kill you because they don't care, because they think that they're dealing with someone who's naive and doesn't understand how to negotiate. So unfortunately for the negotiators, they want to leave you to stew, and therefore the kidnappers to stew for much longer than you're going to feel comfortable with. So that should be something that hopefully you can remember and have in the back of your mind if that hideous situation ever happens to you.
And in that situation where you're so desperate and frightened but have so little power, it really does you no good to be defiant to your kidnappers.
Yes, that's certainly true. You don't want to be singling yourself out from a group as being a difficult obstacle to them getting through their day without any problems. So if you don't want to be putting your hand up and saying, please, you know, get rid of me first because I'm really annoying and obnoxious and I'm going to question everything you do and try and struggle out of the knot every time you try and tie it. On the other hand, there are many people in my book, including James Brandon, who was kidnapped in Iraq in 2004, who suggest that a certain level of defiance is necessary. You have to hold on to your character. You have to do that in a subtle way because you can't just refuse whatever it is their ideology that has driven them to this point. But you have to find a way to stamp your individuality so that they think of you as a human. That's very important too. But perhaps doing it through other methods, like trying to make them aware of that you have a family and trying to annoy them in that way, because that is annoying. You're playing on their guilt, but in a soft way, perhaps, that is not so antagonizing.
Is Brandon the guy who every night when he would go to bed would take off his pants and put them under the mattress to keep them pressed as a sort of sign of his dignity?
Well, that's important, to look smart when you're in a war zone. You never know who you're going to meet as a journalist, this is, and you want to be able to interview somebody with your head held high and not covered in mud or with creased shirts or trousers, because you're just not going to get the same respect if you don't. And the same, you know, if you're meeting anyone, really, it's a good idea to look as smart as possible.
What do you need to know about local bribery customs?
Well, that's something, again, down to the most important lesson I learned while writing this book is listening to the locals. And the locals will tell you how things work. And if the locals that you've learned to trust or gained advice from somebody you do trust who can help you find somebody locally who you can trust, if they're telling you that bribery is a part of everyday life, then listen to them, get prices early. I mean, this is like before you leave the country, if possible, to go abroad, so that you know what you're dealing with at the airport, because that's one of the first points where you might be bribed if there is a lot of bribery going on in the country. And find out a subtle way of giving the bribe, or if the culture demands that you do it in an extravagant and overarchingly sort of show-offy way, then find out that that's the way you've got to do it. But some cultures will be very embarrassed if you give a bribe openly, and others love that. You've got to find it out.
And just about as soon as you arrive, you need to start working on an exit plan. What does that need to involve?
You just dropped out a little bit.
I was asking about when you arrive, as soon as you're there, you start thinking about how you will finally leave, whether that's in a good situation or in an emergency situation. You know how you're going to get out.
Yeah, I think before, I also believe this of holidays now. I mean, it might be that I go on holidays to rather more dangerous people than most people, places than most people. But I always check how it is I would get out of a place if the route that I've chosen to take in is closed for any reason. And this is most necessary if you were to, say, take a holiday walking in Pakistan or right now really anywhere in the Middle East that would have been considered safe a few years ago has now become a bit more treacherous. You need to know if the main exit routes are closed down because of, let's say, a riot erupting or some natural disaster, meaning that the airport was closed down. How are you going to get out? Does your tour company know how to get you out? Does your insurance company cover that cost? That kind of question.
I think it might surprise people, you know, hearing you and reading the interviews that you do and the information you include from other people that have been in these situations. You were not some foolhardy gonzo person who has no sense of danger. In fact, it sounds as if you are more attuned to what might happen than the average person.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I mean, I like being alive and I value it highly. And there are some people you come across in war zones, it was my experience, where people considered the story more important than their lives, those are dangerous people to be around, and they don't tend to get very far in journalism because they don't necessarily make the right judgments at the right time. And I think it's all about being careful and making the right judgments. That there's a risk, but it's a limited risk. It's a risk that you think you can take. I think I was a bit more of a risk taker than some, but less of a risk taker than others. And it's tended to be my friends who were less risk-taking that have done a lot better in their careers than those who were more risk-taking.
Is there a little element of sort of bargaining with fate? Do you feel as if...
That's
all right. You got the phone?
Excuse me, sorry.
Just let us know when you're back with us.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, it's okay. Do you feel like making these preparations, you are able to... Are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you.
Okay, great. Do you feel like making all these preparations in a way is kind of your sense of immunizing yourself to the amount of danger you're in? Does that make any sense? Do you feel like at least if I do these things, I have some control over what is in many cases an uncontrollable situation?
Yeah, I think what's so valuable, the reason I wrote the book is because there was nothing out there that could help me make these decisions. At least now, me and my friends and I, who have read the book, and other people now increasingly, they're able to make these decisions with valuable information to base those, on which to base those decisions. Before, when I was going anywhere, I was making it up, and so were all my friends, and so were all my colleagues. And now I feel like I've got this valuable resource, and sometimes I choose to listen to myself, and sometimes I don't. Like, for instance, I got mugged in South Africa last year because I wasn't really listening to my own advice, because I felt like I was on holiday and I wasn't listening. So that's just one of those things. It's not always, you don't always listen to your own advice.
Rosie Garthwaite is a journalist with Al Jazeera. We're talking about her new book, How to Avoid Being Killed in a War Zone, The Essential Survival Guide for Dangerous Places. We'll come back to our talk with Rosie in a couple of minutes. You can join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Al Jazeera journalist Rosie Garthwaite. Her new book is called How to Avoid Being Killed in a War Zone, The Essential Survival Guide for Dangerous Places. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I'm curious, Rosie, about what it takes, either immediately following or even during a very dangerous experience, to focus your mind on the small details of a story you have to file on deadline?
It depends on the nature of a very dangerous instance. I'll reference back to something that I experienced. I was in Baghdad in 2003, in August 2003, when the UN building was blown up there. It was really the first time that journalists and NGO workers and people who were there working in what they thought was going to be, they hoped was going to be a better Iraq, or working for a better Iraq. It was the first time that anyone really questioned the safety of what was going on. And from there, it just went downhill in Iraq. And I lived very close. I rushed to the scene, and my own windows had been burst open. I expected that four of my colleagues were in the room that had been blown up. Luckily, all four of them had been stuck in the traffic. But I was there as a journalist, but also as a friend, as a colleague. It's a very complex situation when these things are right on top of you, because you all do move in gangs. And there are, in terms of, if there's going to be a danger to someone else, it's highly likely that the danger is also to you. So your first thought should be to your own safety. And that sometimes becomes the overwhelming thought, and the story comes much, much later in the day, maybe hours afterwards when you're free and safe. Or it might be that you can do both things at the same time. But in my advice and my experience from having talked to so many different people is that you should follow your own instincts, and your instincts are not going to tell you, quick, get the story, if it's going to risk your safety. You know, if it's a calculated risk that doesn't seem to weigh in your favor, then don't take it.
What does it take to gauge the state of your own mental and emotional health after days and days or weeks and weeks of traumatic events?
Many people never get to grips with reading their own emotional health. I think it's one of it's a real problem, and it's what sends people back into war zones again and again. Soldiers will speak of this as well, some of whom are in my book. There's this desire to go back because it feels like like normality. That experience, that extreme adrenaline, the need to be surrounded by colleagues who have experienced the same thing as you, people that have experienced the same thing as you, becomes normal. Many people in my book, I'll give you an example, Giles Trendall, who is a senior producer at Al Jazeera, he experienced trauma only about a year and a half after his own extended period inside a really dangerous place, which at the time was Lebanon in the 90s, where he was shot at on a day-to-day basis and took increasing risks to the point where he thinks he was actually on the verge of probably some sort of suicidal risks to in order to get what he felt was a story. Looking back at it, he realized it was actually more about the adrenaline rush than about getting the story. And that's very true for many other people. NGO worker Sam Bolton, who used to be has been a press spokesman for many of the top NGOs that you will have heard of. She regularly has relapses and has to go back, take 6 months off at a time due to some of the things she's experienced. It's not something that you can always predict has been dealt with, your emotional health.
There are people who would ask why anybody would go back and do this voluntarily. Is there a certain kind of temperament that is common to people that you meet in the field?
Yes, there is a certain kind of temperament. We're easily bored, that's true, and that can be dangerous as well. Boredom is just as dangerous as being perhaps faced with a daily excitement and adrenaline. Because you get more curious than you should be and end up in places that you don't want to go. I remember I remember one of our fixers in Kabul was saying there is nothing he hates more than a journalist who comes in, gets bored, and decides that they want to go and look for carpets in Kabul, and all of the dangers that result in that, wandering around with wads of cash looking for expensive carpets, openly being a sort of tourist while in a place that you really shouldn't be being a tourist. So that can be a problem. It's certainly true that most people who go back again and again will be going back not for money, not for glory, but because they feel they owe a debt of gratitude to the people on the ground that they meet and feel that they want to tell their stories. There's been a lot of talk recently, particularly after some of the attacks in Cairo, of gung-ho journalism. And I think if you have a look around at the people who are on air and behind the scenes, there are very, very few people who do it for sort of thrills and kicks. It's mainly because they feel they have to be there, and also because home doesn't feel like home anymore.
Do you ever think that you know a story and then you go in there and you realize that you don't? And I'm wondering if there are certain times when working for Al Jazeera is somehow protective in a way that working for the New York Times wouldn't be.
Yeah, well, those are two very separate questions. On the first one, I love it when I have a predetermined idea of what something is and it's completely different. That means that you are really understanding a story. If you go in and everything you've read turns out to be true, then you're not really getting beneath the skin of a story, in my experience. And the best stories are the ones that change at the very last minute and become something completely different to how you thought it was going to be. Being a journalist for Al Jazeera has its huge advantages and disadvantages. During the elections, the U.S. elections, we couldn't get anyone to talk to us whatsoever, and that was very difficult. So we are now more favoured by the government, but still people are very suspicious of us, despite all of our attempts to try and prove that we are part of the mainstream and that we're not very radical. And in some areas, Al Jazeera Arabic has been there for a long time and gained a great reputation. And the other problem, but there can be other problems where Al Jazeera Arabic has been there and been the only people questioning the regime or government that's in place. So somewhere like Yemen is an example of this, where they're the only ones who've been regularly there on their doorstep, pestering them and asking them the right kind of questions. Therefore, Al Jazeera is a difficult people to work for when you're talking about Yemen, because if I was working for someone else, we wouldn't have been so annoying to the government there for so many years.
Have you ever thought about carrying weapons with you?
No, it's not something I agree with. And all the advice, it was one of the top questions I wanted to answer through the writing of my book. And I think the answer, having spoken to so many people, is that journalists definitely shouldn't be carrying weapons. One of the main reasons is, or in fact anyone who isn't a soldier or a mercenary shouldn't be carrying weapons. One of the main reasons is that the Geneva Convention deems that if you are carrying a weapon then in a place of danger or where there is considered to be battle, something that falls under the Geneva Convention's understanding of war, you are a mercenary. You're classed as a mercenary. So there are some journalists who carry weapons, but less and less of them do. In Iraq, there were lots, and by the time I went back to Iraq in 2007, there were very, very few. Mainly people now employ security guards to carry the weapons for them if they choose to. On the other hand, there are some journalists I know. Zaina Hodder, who's in Libya right now working for Al Jazeera, she hates security guards having weapons around her. She feels that people should not be carrying weapons. If they're journalists, they should only be carrying guns. That's down to the individual again. And sometimes organizations insist on people having security with them, and sometimes organizations are a bit more flexible. So it's down to whichever organization you work for.
Can you talk about what you'd like to carry with you in your grab bag, which I gather is the thing that you could grab at a moment's notice and be out the door?
Well, we've already talked about a couple of them. The essential need for some ready cash that help you bribe your way out of a situation or buy yourself a quick plane ticket if you need to. You need to have all your ID in there. Box of matches is always useful if, for instance, there's a massive electricity cut, a torch. Your very well-charged communications kit, whatever you can carry with you. We're talking about quite a small bag, so really only a day's worth of water and perhaps some food if you can. Those are useful things to have in there. I've probably left a couple of things off the list, but really those are the most important ones. You know, you need to have all your ID. And some people suggest that you shouldn't take ID if, for instance, there's a possibility of kidnapping, because they'll know who you are, which nationality you are instantly. And in those circumstances, then really you've got to take the advice of the locals. If the locals don't feel comfortable with you carrying a British or a US passport or a French or whatever it is that's unpopular at the time, then you should leave your passport at home. But carry perhaps another way to identify yourself that doesn't tell people what your nationality is.
You know, this makes logical sense, but I confess I hadn't been aware that when traveling through the Middle East, there are places where you really shouldn't have an Israeli passport stamp, and there are other places trying to get into Israel where there are other countries that you shouldn't have their passport stamp. What do you do about that?
Yeah, well, trying to get into Israel with many different stamps in your passport can be very difficult. They're a little bit more flexible now, Israel. On the other hand, if you are of Palestinian descent and you have anything in your passport whatsoever, you're very unlikely to get in. The other way around, traveling with an Israeli stamp in your passport around the Middle East and even beyond that, just to many places in Africa too, it's just not acceptable. They don't want to accept people who have been freely traveling in Israel as a tourist into their country. So the best way to get away with this to get around this is to have a piece of paper with you and ask the Israeli border staff to stamp that instead. And it's now like a regular deal. It's very normal to ask for that to happen.
So they understand that this is happening.
Yeah, they certainly do.
What do you do if you suspect that you're under surveillance?
Well, it depends what it's for, really, why you think you're under surveillance. I guess as a normal person, as a tourist, perhaps the reason you'd be under surveillance is because there might be somebody, let's say, if you were traveling in Venezuela or Colombia, you're under surveillance for people to kidnap you, to try and work out whether you should be kidnapped. And in those circumstances, try and change your routine as much as possible. In most of these places, if you are of a certain wealth level, and I'm not talking particularly rich, I'm talking pretty average rich, but somebody that might be able to squeeze more out of their richer government than the local one, then just try and change your routine as often as possible. Make sure you're working with people you trust. Always check references. For people that are working with you, particularly drivers, that's very important. You know their affiliation. On the other hand, if you're you think you're perhaps under surveillance for the work you're doing in a place, then there's very little you can do to avoid government surveillance, but you can avoid being overheard in terms of technology. So try and do Skype phone calls. They don't tend to be traceable. But Skype messaging will be, for instance. BlackBerry messaging is now used to be a way of messaging that was above and beyond governments, but now it seems to be accessible to all. So there's very few ways to get around surveillance by government. Using the traditional spy techniques of sending middlemen with messages is probably the best way.
So are you in London now?
I'm actually in Scotland, in the Highlands of Scotland.
Are you longing for some danger?
Well, I'm quite sad to be missing out on what's going on in Libya. That's been amazing coverage by many of my colleagues and friends from all sorts of different organizations who are over there. I myself have not been in Libya. I flew in for 40 minutes on a story when I was following weapons in from Qatar. But other than that, I've been watching it from afar, from the newsroom. But no, I don't sort of look for danger. I've been on a few quite exciting long walks in the Scottish Highland. That's enough for me for the moment.
Well, we hope that you'll be safe now and certainly into the future.
Thank you very much.
Rosie Garthwaite is a journalist with Al Jazeera. Her new book is called How to Avoid Being Killed in a War Zone, The Essential Survival Guide for Dangerous Places. My name is Chris Boyd. We really appreciate you listening and wish that you have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.